The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley. Narrated by Rudolf Shermer.
It was in 1886 that the German pharmacologist Louis Levin published the first systematic study of the cactus, to which his own name was subsequently given. Anhalonium levinii was new to science. To primitive religion and the Indians of Mexico and the American Southwest, it was a friend of immemorially long standing. Indeed, it was much more than a friend. In the words of one of the early Spanish visitors to the New World, "They eat a root which they call peyote, and which they venerate as though it were a deity." Why they should have venerated it as a deity became apparent when such eminent psychologists as Jentsch, Havelock Ellis, and Weir Mitchell began their experiments with mescaline, the active principle of peyote. True, they stopped short at a point well this side of idolatry, but all concurred in assigning to mescaline a position among drugs of unique distinction. Administered in suitable doses, it changes the quality of consciousness more profoundly, and yet is less toxic than any other substance in the pharmacologist's repertory. Mescaline research has been going on sporadically ever since the days of Levin and Havelock Ellis. Chemists have not merely isolated the alkaloid, they have learned how to synthesize it, so that the supply no longer depends on the sparse and intermittent crop of a desert cactus. Alienists have dosed themselves with mescaline in the hope thereby of coming to a better, a first-hand understanding of their patients' mental processes, working unfortunately upon too few subjects within too narrow a range of circumstances. Psychologists have observed and catalogued some of the drug's more striking effects. Neurologists and physiologists have found out something about the mechanism of its action upon the central nervous system. And at least one professional philosopher has taken mescaline for the light it may throw on such ancient, unsolved riddles as the place of mind in nature and the relationship between brain and consciousness. There matters rested until, 2 or 3 years ago, a new and perhaps highly significant fact was observed. Actually, the fact had been staring everyone in the face for several decades. But nobody, as it happened, had noticed it until a young English psychiatrist, at present working in Canada, was struck by the close similarity in chemical composition between mescaline and adrenaline. Further research revealed that lysergic acid, an extremely potent hallucinogen derived from ergot, has a structural biochemical relationship to the others. Then came the discovery that adrenochrome, which is a product of the decomposition of adrenaline, can produce many of the symptoms observed in mescaline intoxication. But adrenochrome probably occurs spontaneously in the human body. In other words, each one of us may be capable of manufacturing a chemical, minute doses of which are known to cause profound changes in consciousness. Certain of these changes are similar to those which occur in that most characteristic plague of the 20th century, schizophrenia. Is the mental disorder due to a chemical disorder? And is the chemical disorder due in its turn to psychological distresses affecting the adrenals? It would be rash and premature to affirm it. The most we can say is that some kind of a prima facie case has been made out. Meanwhile, the clue is being systematically followed. The sleuths, biochemists, psychiatrists, psychologists, are on the trail. By a series of, for me, extremely fortunate circumstances, I found myself in the spring of 1953, squarely athwart that trail. One of the sleuths had come on business to California. In spite of 70 years of mescaline research, the psychological material at his disposal was still absurdly inadequate, and he was anxious to add to it. I was on the spot and willing, indeed eager, to be a guinea pig. Thus it came about that one bright May morning I swallowed 4/10 of a gram of mescaline, dissolved in half a glass of water, and sat down to wait for the results. We live together, we act on and react to one another. But always, and in all circumstances, we are by ourselves. The martyrs go hand in hand into the arena. They are crucified alone. Embraced, the lovers desperately try to fuse their insulated ecstasies into a single self-transcendence. In vain. By its very nature, every embodied spirit is doomed to suffer and enjoy in solitude. Sensations, feelings, insights, fancies, all these are private, and except through symbols and at second hand, incommunicable. We can pool information about experiences, but never the experiences themselves. From family to nation, every human group is a society of island universes. Most island universes are sufficiently like one another to permit of inferential understanding or even of mutual empathy or feeling into. Thus, remembering our own bereavements and humiliations, we can condole with others in analogous circumstances, can put ourselves, always of course in a slightly Pickwickian sense, in their places. But in certain cases, communication between universes is incomplete or even non-existent. The mind is its own place, and the places inhabited by the insane and the exceptionally gifted are so different from the places where ordinary men and women live that there is little or no common ground of memory to serve as a basis for understanding or fellow feeling. Words are uttered, but fail to enlighten. The things and events to which the symbols refer belong to mutually exclusive realms of experience. To see ourselves as others see us is a most salutary gift. Hardly less important is the capacity to see others as they see themselves. But what if these others belong to a different species and inhabit a radically alien universe? For example, how can the sane get to know what it actually feels like to be mad? Or, short of being born again as a visionary, a medium, or a musical genius, how can we ever visit the worlds which to Blake, to Swedenborg, to Johann Sebastian Bach were home? And how can a man at the extreme limits of ectomorphy and cerebrotonia ever put himself in the place of one at the limits of endomorphy and viscerotonia, or, except within certain circumscribed areas, share the feelings of one who stands at the limits of mesomorphy and somatotonia? To the unmitigated behaviorist, such questions, I suppose, are meaningless. But for those who theoretically believe what in practice they know to be true, namely, that there is an inside to experience as well as an outside, the problems posed are real problems, all the more grave, for being some completely insoluble, some soluble only in exceptional circumstances, and by methods not available to everyone. Thus it seems virtually certain that I shall never know what it feels like to be Sir John Falstaff or Joe Lewis. On the other hand, it had always seemed to me possible that through hypnosis, for example, or auto-hypnosis, by means of systematic medication or else by taking the appropriate drug. I might so change my ordinary mode of consciousness as to be able to know from the inside what the visionary, the medium, even the mystic were talking about. From what I had read of the mescaline experience, I was convinced in advance that the drug would admit me, at least for a few hours, into the kind of inner world described by Blake and A.E. But what I had expected did not happen. I had expected to lie with my eyes shut, looking at visions of many-colored geometries, of animated architectures, rich with gems and fabulously lovely, of landscapes with heroic figures, of symbolic dramas trembling perpetually on the verge of the ultimate revelation. But I had not reckoned, it was evident, with the idiosyncrasies of my mental makeup, the facts of my temperament, training, and habits. I am, and for as long as I can remember, I have always been a poor visualizer. Words, even the pregnant words of poets, do not evoke pictures in my mind. No hypnagogic visions greet me on the verge of sleep. When I recall something, the memory does not present itself to me as a vividly seen event or object. By an effort of the will, I can evoke a not very vivid image of what happened yesterday afternoon, of how the Lungarno used to look before the bridges were destroyed, of the Bayswater Road when the only buses were green and tiny and drawn by aged horses at 3.5 miles an hour. But such images have little substance and absolutely no autonomous life of their own. They stand to real, perceived objects in the same relation as Homer's ghosts stood to the men of flesh and blood who came to visit them in the shades. Only when I have a high temperature do my mental images come to independent life. To those in whom the faculty of visualization is strong, my inner world must seem curiously drab, limited, and uninteresting. This was the world, a poor thing, but my own, which I expected to see transformed into something completely unlike itself. The change which actually took place in that world was in no sense revolutionary. Half an hour after swallowing the drug, I became aware of a slow dance of golden lights. A little later, there were sumptuous red surfaces swelling and expanding from bright nodes of energy that vibrated with a continuously changing, patterned life. At another time, the closing of my eyes revealed a complex of gray structures, within which pale bluish spheres kept emerging into intense solidity, and having emerged, would slide noiselessly upwards out of sight. But at no time were there faces or forms of men or animals. I saw no landscapes, no enormous spaces, no magical growth and metamorphosis of buildings, nothing remotely like a drama or a parable. The other world to which mescaline admitted me was not the world of visions. It existed out there in what I could see with my eyes open. The great change was in the realm of objective fact. What had happened to my subjective universe was relatively unimportant. I took my pill at 11. An hour and a half later, I was sitting in my study, looking intently at a small glass vase. The vase contained only 3 flowers, a full-blown Belle of Portugal rose, shell pink with a hint at every petal's base of a hotter, flamier hue, a large magenta and cream-colored carnation, and, pale purple at the end of its broken stalk, the bold heraldic blossom of an iris. Fortuitous and provisional, the little nosegay broke all the rules of traditional good taste. At breakfast that morning, I had been struck by the lively dissonance of its colors, but that was no longer the point. I was not looking now at an unusual flower arrangement. I was seeing what Adam had seen on the morning of his creation, the miracle, moment by moment, of naked existence. "Is it agreeable?" somebody asked. During this part of the experiment, all conversations were recorded on a dictating machine, and it has been possible for me to refresh my memory of what was said. "Neither agreeable nor disagreeable," I answered. "It just is." "Istigkeit, wasn't that the word Meister Eckhart liked to use? Isness, the being of Platonic philosophy, except that Plato seems to have made the enormous, the grotesque mistake of separating being from becoming and identifying it with the mathematical abstraction of the idea. He could never, poor fellow, have seen a bunch of flowers shining with their own inner light and all but quivering under the pressure of the significance with which they were charged, could never have perceived that what rose and iris and carnation so intensely signified was nothing more and nothing less than what they were, a transience that was yet eternal life, a perpetual perishing that was at the same time pure being, a bundle of minute, unique particulars in which, by some unspeakable and yet self-evident paradox, was to be seen the divine source of all existence. I continued to look at the flowers, and in their living light I seemed to detect the qualitative equivalent of breathing. But of a breathing without returns to a starting point, with no recurrent ebbs, but only a repeated flow from beauty to heightened beauty, from deeper to ever deeper meaning. Words like grace and transfiguration came to my mind, and this, of course, was what, among other things, they stood for. My eyes traveled from the rose to the carnation, and from that feathery incandescence to the smooth scrolls of sentient amethyst, which were the iris. The beatific vision, Sat Chit Ananda, being, awareness, bliss, for the first time I understood, not on the verbal level, not by inchoate hints or at a distance, but precisely and completely what those prodigious syllables referred to. And then I remembered a passage I had read in one of Suzuki's essays. What is the Dharma body of the Buddha? The Dharma body of the Buddha is another way of saying mind, suchness, the void, the Godhead. The question is asked in a Zen monastery by an earnest and bewildered novice, and with the prompt irrelevance of one of the Marx brothers, the master answers, "The hedge at the bottom of the garden." And the man who realizes this truth, the novice dubiously inquires, "What, may I ask, is he?" Groucho gives him a whack over the shoulders with his staff and answers, "A golden-haired lion." It had been, when I read it, only a vaguely pregnant piece of nonsense. Now it was all as clear as day, as evident as Euclid. Of course the Dharma body of the Buddha was the hedge at the bottom of the garden. At the same time, and no less obviously, it was these flowers, it was anything that I, or rather the blessed not I, released for a moment from my throttling embrace, cared to look at. The books, for example, with which my study walls were lined, like the flowers, they glowed when I looked at them, with brighter colors, a profounder significance. Red books like rubies, emerald books, books bound in white jade, books of agate, of aquamarine, of yellow topaz, lapis lazuli books whose color was so intense, so intrinsically meaningful, that they seemed to be on the point of leaving the shelves to thrust themselves more insistently on my attention. "What about spatial relationships?" the investigator inquired as I was looking at the books. It was difficult to answer. True, the perspective looked rather odd, and the walls of the room no longer seemed to meet in right angles. But these were not the really important facts. The really important facts were that spatial relationships had ceased to matter very much, and that my mind was perceiving the world in terms of other than spatial categories. At ordinary times, the eye concerns itself with such problems as where, how far, how situated in relation to what. In the mescaline experience, the implied questions to which the eye responds are of another order. Place and distance cease to be of much interest. The mind does its perceiving in terms of intensity of existence, profundity of significance, relationships within a pattern. I saw the books, but was not at all concerned with their positions in space. What I noticed, what impressed itself upon my mind, was the fact that all of them glowed with living light, and that in some the glory was more manifest than in others. In this context, position and the three dimensions were beside the point. Not, of course, that the category of space had been abolished. When I got up and walked about, I could do so quite normally, without misjudging the whereabouts of objects. Space was still there, but it had lost its predominance. The mind was primarily concerned not with measures and locations, but with being and meaning. And along with indifference to space, there went an even more complete indifference to time. "There seems to be plenty of it," was all I would answer when the investigator asked me to say what I felt about time. Plenty of it, but exactly how much was entirely irrelevant. I could, of course, have looked at my watch, but my watch, I knew, was in another universe. My actual experience had been, was still, of an indefinite duration, or alternatively, of a perpetual present, made up of one continually changing apocalypse. From the books, the investigator directed my attention to the furniture. A small typing table stood in the center of the room. Beyond it, from my point of view, was a wicker chair, and beyond that, a desk. The three pieces formed an intricate pattern of horizontals, uprights, and diagonals, a pattern all the more interesting for not being interpreted in terms of spatial relationships. Table, chair, and desk came together in a composition that was like something by Braque or Juan Gris, a still life recognizably related to the objective world, but rendered without depth, without any attempt at photographic realism. I was looking at my furniture not as the utilitarian who has to sit on chairs to write at desks and tables, and not as the cameraman or scientific recorder, but as the pure aesthete whose concern is only with forms and their relationships within the field of vision or the picture space. But as I looked, this purely aesthetic cubist's eye view gave place to what I can only describe as the sacramental vision of reality. I was back where I had been when I was looking at the flowers, back in a world where everything shone with the inner light and was infinite in its significance. The legs, for example, of that chair how miraculous their tubularity, how supernatural their polished smoothness. I spent several minutes, or was it several centuries, not merely gazing at those bamboo legs, but actually being them, or rather being myself in them, or, to be still more accurate, for I was not involved in the case, nor in a certain sense were they, being my not-self in the not-self which was the chair. Reflecting on my experience, I find myself agreeing with the eminent Cambridge philosopher Dr. C. D. Broad, that we should do well to consider much more seriously than we have hitherto been inclined to do the type of theory which Bergson put forward in connection with memory and sense perception. The suggestion is that the function of the brain and nervous system and sense organs is in the main eliminative and not productive. Each person is at each moment capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. The function of the brain and nervous system is to protect us from being overwhelmed and confused by this mass of largely useless and irrelevant knowledge, by shutting out most of what we should otherwise perceive or remember at any moment, and leaving only that very small and special selection which is likely to be practically useful. According to such a theory, each one of us is potentially mind at large. But insofar as we are animals, our business is at all costs to survive. To make biological survival possible, mind at large has to be funneled through the reducing valve of the brain and nervous system. What comes out at the other end is a measly trickle of the kind of consciousness which will help us to stay alive on the surface of this particular planet. To formulate and express the contents of this reduced awareness, man has invented and endlessly elaborated those symbol systems and implicit philosophies which we call languages. Every individual is at once the beneficiary and the victim of the linguistic tradition into which he has been born. The beneficiary, inasmuch as language gives access to the accumulated records of other people's experience, the victim, insofar as it confirms him in the belief that reduced awareness is the only awareness, and as it bedevils his sense of reality, so that he is all too apt to take his concepts for data, his words for actual things. That which, in the language of religion, is called this world, is the universe of reduced awareness, expressed and, as it were, petrified by language. The various other worlds with which human beings erratically make contact are so many elements in the totality of the awareness belonging to mind at large. Most people, most of the time, know only what comes through the reducing valve and is consecrated as genuinely real by the local language. Certain persons, however, seem to be born with a kind of bypass that circumvents the reducing valve. In others, temporary bypasses may be acquired either spontaneously or as the result of deliberate spiritual exercises, or through hypnosis, or by means of drugs. Through these permanent or temporary bypasses there flows not indeed the perception of everything that is happening everywhere in the universe, for the bypass does not abolish the reducing valve, which still excludes the total content of mind at large, but something more than, and above all something different from, the carefully selected utilitarian material which our narrowed individual minds regard as a complete, or at least sufficient, picture of reality. The brain is provided with a number of enzyme systems which serve to coordinate its workings. Some of these enzymes regulate the supply of glucose to the brain cells. mescaline inhibits the production of these enzymes and thus lowers the amount of glucose available to an organ that is in constant need of sugar. When mescaline reduces the brain's normal ration of sugar, what happens? Too few cases have been observed, and therefore a comprehensive answer cannot yet be given. But what happens to the majority of the few who have taken mescaline under supervision can be summarized as follows. 1. The ability to remember and to think straight is little, if at all, reduced. Listening to the recordings of my conversation under the influence of the drug, I cannot discover that I was then any stupider than I am at ordinary times. 2. Visual impressions are greatly intensified, and the eye recovers some of the perceptual innocence of childhood, when the sensum was not immediately and automatically subordinated to the concept. Interest in space is diminished, and interest in time falls almost to zero. 3. Though the intellect remains unimpaired, and though perception is enormously improved, the will suffers a profound change for the worse. The mescaline taker sees no reason for doing anything in particular, and finds most of the causes for which at ordinary times he was prepared to act and suffer profoundly uninteresting. He can't be bothered with them, for the good reason that he has better things to think about. 4. These better things may be experienced, as I experienced them, out there or in here, or in both worlds, the inner and the outer, simultaneously or successively. That they are better seems to be self-evident to all mescaline takers, who come to the drug with a sound liver and an untroubled mind. These effects of mescaline are the sort of effects you could expect to follow the administration of a drug having the power to impair the efficiency of the cerebral reducing valve. When the brain runs out of sugar, the undernourished ego grows weak, can't be bothered to undertake the necessary chores, and loses all interest in those spatial and temporal relationships which mean so much to an organism bent on getting on in the world. As mind at large seeps past the no longer watertight valve, all kinds of biologically useless things start to happen. In some cases, there may be extrasensory perceptions. Other persons discover a world of visionary beauty. To others, again, is revealed the glory, the infinite value and meaningfulness of naked existence, of the given, unconceptualized event. In the final stage of egolessness, there is an obscure knowledge that all is in all, that all is actually each. This is as near, I take it, as a finite mind can ever come to perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. In this context, how significant is the enormous heightening under mescaline of the perception of color? For certain animals, it is biologically very important to be able to distinguish certain hues. But beyond the limits of their utilitarian spectrum, most creatures are completely colorblind. Bees, for example, spend most of their time deflowering the fresh virgins of the spring. But as von Frisch has shown, they can recognize only a very few colors. Man's highly developed color sense is a biological luxury, inestimably precious to him as an intellectual and spiritual being, but unnecessary to his survival as an animal. To judge by the adjectives which Homer puts into their mouths, the heroes of the Trojan War hardly excelled the bees in their capacity to distinguish colors. In this respect, at least, mankind's advance has been prodigious. Mescaline raises all colors to a higher power, and makes the percipient aware of innumerable fine shades of difference. to which, at ordinary times, he is completely blind. It would seem that for mind at large, the so-called secondary characters of things are primary. Unlike Locke, it evidently feels that colors are more important, better worth attending to, than masses, positions, and dimensions. Like mescaline takers, many mystics perceive supernaturally brilliant colors, not only with the inward eye, but even in the objective world around them. Similar reports are made by psychics and sensitives. There are certain mediums to whom the mescaline taker's brief revelation is a matter during long periods of daily and hourly experience. From this long but indispensable excursion into the realms of theory, we may now return to the miraculous facts. 4 bamboo chair legs in the middle of a room. Like Wordsworth's daffodils, they brought all manner of wealth, the gift beyond price of a new direct insight into the very nature of things, together with a more modest treasure of understanding in the field especially of the arts. A rose is a rose is a rose. But these chair legs were chair legs, were Saint Michael and all angels. 4 or 5 hours after the event, when the effects of a cerebral sugar shortage were wearing off, I was taken for a little tour of the city, which included a visit towards sundown to what is modestly claimed to be the world's biggest drugstore. At the back of the WBDS, among the toys, the greeting cards, and the comics, stood a row, surprisingly enough, of art books. I picked up the first volume that came to hand. It was on Van Gogh, and the picture at which the book opened was the chair, that astounding portrait of a Ding an sich, which the mad painter saw with a kind of adoring terror and tried to render on his canvas. But it was a task to which the power even of genius proved wholly inadequate. The chair Van Gogh had seen was obviously the same in essence as the chair I had seen. But, though incomparably more real than the chairs of ordinary perception, the chair in his picture remained no more than an unusually expressive symbol of the fact. The fact had been manifested suchness. This was only an emblem. Such emblems are sources of true knowledge about the nature of things, and this true knowledge may serve to prepare the mind which accepts it for immediate insights on its own account. But that is all. However expressive, symbols can never be the things they stand for. It would be interesting in this context to make a study of the works of art available to the great knowers of suchness. What sort of pictures did Eckhart look at? What sculptures and paintings played a part in the religious experience of St. John of the Cross, of Hakuin, of Hui Neng, of William Law? The questions are beyond my power to answer, but I strongly suspect that most of the great knowers of suchness paid very little attention to art, some refusing to have anything to do with it at all, others being content with what a critical eye would regard as second-rate or even tenth-rate works. To a person whose transfigured and transfiguring mind can see the all in every this, the first-rateness or tenth-rateness of even a religious painting will be a matter of the most sovereign indifference. Art, I suppose, is only for beginners, or else for those resolute dead-enders who have made up their minds to be content with the ersatz of suchness, with symbols rather than with what they signify, with the elegantly composed recipe in lieu of actual dinner. I returned the Van Gogh to its rack and picked up the volume standing next to it. It was a book on Botticelli. I turned the pages. The Birth of Venus, never one of my favorites. Mars and Venus, that loveliness so passionately denounced by poor Ruskin at the height of his long-drawn sexual tragedy, the marvelously rich and intricate calumny of Apelles, and then a somewhat less familiar and not very good picture, Judith. My attention was arrested, and I gazed in fascination, not at the pale neurotic heroine or her attendant, not at the victim's hairy head or the vernal landscape in the background, but at the purplish silk of Judith's pleated bodice and long, wind-blown skirts. This was something I had seen before, seen that very morning between the flowers and the furniture, when I looked down by chance and went on passionately staring by choice at my own crossed legs. Those folds in the trousers, what a labyrinth of endlessly significant complexity! And the texture of the grey flannel, how rich, how deeply, mysteriously sumptuous! And here they were again, in Botticelli's picture. Civilized human beings wear clothes. Therefore there can be no portraiture, no mythological or historical storytelling without representations of folded textiles. But though it may account for the origins, mere tailoring can never explain the luxuriant development of drapery as a major theme of all the plastic arts. Artists, it is obvious, have always loved drapery for its own sake, or rather for their own. When you paint or carve drapery, you are painting or carving forms which, for all practical purposes, are non-representational, the kind of unconditioned forms on which artists, even in the most naturalistic tradition, like to let themselves go. In the average Madonna or Apostle, the strictly human, fully representational element accounts for about 10% of the whole. All the rest consists of many-colored variations on the inexhaustible theme of crumpled wool or linen. And these non-representational 9/10 of a Madonna or an Apostle may be just as important qualitatively as they are in quantity. Very often they set the tone of the whole work of art. They state the key in which the theme is being rendered. They express the mood, the temperament, the attitude to life of the artist. Stoical serenity reveals itself in the smooth surfaces, the broad, untortured folds of Piero's draperies. Torn between fact and wish, between cynicism and idealism, Bernini tempers the all but caricatural verisimilitude of his faces with enormous sartorial abstractions, which are the embodiment, in stone or bronze, of the everlasting commonplaces of rhetoric. The heroism, the holiness, the sublimity to which mankind perpetually aspires, for the most part, in vain. And here are El Greco's disquietingly visceral skirts and mantles. Here are the sharp, twisting, flame-like folds in which Cosimo Tura clothes his figures. In the first, traditional spirituality breaks down into a nameless physiological yearning. In the second, there writhes an agonized sense of the world's essential strangeness and hostility. Or consider Watteau. His men and women play lutes, get ready for balls and harlequinades, embark on velvet lawns and under noble trees for the cithara of every lover's dream. Their enormous melancholy and the flayed, excruciating sensibility of their creator find expression not in the actions recorded, not in the gestures and the faces portrayed, but in the relief and texture of their taffeta skirts, their satin capes and doublets. Not an inch of smooth surface here, not a moment of peace or confidence, only a silken wilderness of countless tiny pleats and wrinkles, with an incessant modulation, inner uncertainty rendered with the perfect assurance of a master hand. Of tone into tone, of one indeterminate color into another. In life, man proposes, God disposes. In the plastic arts, the proposing is done by the subject matter. That which disposes is ultimately the artist's temperament. Proximately, at least in portraiture, history, and genre, the carved or painted drapery. Between them, these two may decree that a fête galante shall move to tears, that a crucifixion shall be serene to the point of cheerfulness, that a stigmatization shall be almost intolerably sexy, that the likeness of a prodigy of female brainlessness, I am thinking now of Ingres' incomparable Madame Wattissier, shall express the austerest, the most uncompromising intellectuality. But this is not the whole story. Draperies, as I had now discovered, are much more than devices for the introduction of non-representational forms into naturalistic paintings and sculptures. What the rest of us see only under the influence of mescaline, the artist is congenitally equipped to see all the time. His perception is not limited to what is biologically or socially useful. A little of the knowledge belonging to mind at large oozes past the reducing valve of brain and ego into his consciousness. It is a knowledge of the intrinsic significance of every existent. For the artist as for the mescaline taker, draperies are living hieroglyphs that stand in some peculiarly expressive way for the unfathomable mystery of pure being. More even than the chair, though less perhaps than those holy supernatural flowers, the folds of my gray flannel trousers were charged with isness. To what they owed this privileged status, I cannot say. Is it perhaps because the forms of folded drapery are so strange and dramatic that they catch the eye and in this way force the miraculous fact of sheer existence upon the attention? Who knows? What is important is less the reason for the experience than the experience itself. Poring over Judith's skirts there in the world's biggest drugstore, I knew that Botticelli, and not Botticelli alone, but many others too, had looked at draperies with the same transfigured and transfiguring eyes as had been mine that morning. They had seen the Istigkeit, the allness and infinity of folded cloth, and had done their best to render it in paint or stone. Necessarily, of course, without success, for the glory and the wonder of pure existence belong to another order, beyond the power of even the highest art to express. But in Judith's skirt I could clearly see what, if I had been a painter of genius, I might have made of my old gray flannels. Not much, heaven knows, in comparison with the reality, but enough to delight generation after generation of beholders, enough to make them understand at least a little of the true significance of what in our pathetic imbecility we call mere things and disregard in favor of television. This is how one ought to see, I kept saying as I looked down at my trousers, or glanced at the jeweled books in the shelves at the legs of my infinitely more than Van Goghian chair. This is how one ought to see how things really are. And yet there were reservations, for if one always saw like this, one would never want to do anything else. Just looking, just being the divine not-self of flower, of book, of chair, of flannel. That would be enough. But in that case, what about other people? What about human relations? In the recording of that morning's conversations, I find the question constantly repeated, what about human relations? How could one reconcile this timeless bliss of seeing as one ought to see, with the temporal duties of doing what one ought to do and feeling as one ought to feel. One ought to be able, I said, to see these trousers as infinitely important, and human beings as still more infinitely important. One ought, but in practice it seemed to be impossible. This participation in the manifest glory of things left no room, so to speak, for the ordinary, the necessary concerns of human existence, above all for concerns involving persons. For persons are selves, and in one respect at least, I was now a not-self, simultaneously perceiving and being the not-self of the things around me. To this newborn not-self, the behavior, the appearance, the very thought of the self, it had momentarily ceased to be, and of other selves, its one-time fellows, seemed not indeed distasteful, for distastefulness was not one of the categories in terms of which I was thinking, but enormously irrelevant. Compelled by the investigator to analyze and report on what I was doing, and how I longed to be left alone with eternity in a flower, infinity in four chair legs, and the absolute in the folds of a pair of flannel trousers, I realized that I was deliberately avoiding the eyes of those who were with me in the room, deliberately refraining from being too much aware of them. One was my wife, the other a man I respected and greatly liked, but both belonged to the world from which, for the moment, mescaline had delivered me. The world of selves, of time, of moral judgments and utilitarian considerations. The world, and it was this aspect of human life which I wished above all else to forget, of self-assertion, of cocksureness, of overvalued words and idolatrously worshipped notions. At this stage of the proceedings, I was handed a large colored reproduction of the well-known self-portrait by Cézanne. The head and shoulders of a man in a large straw hat, red-cheeked, red-lipped, with rich black whiskers and a dark, unfriendly eye. It is a magnificent painting, but it was not as a painting that I now saw it, for the head promptly took on a third dimension, and came to life as a small, goblin-like man, looking out through a window in the page before me. I started to laugh, and when they asked me why, "What pretensions," I kept repeating, "who on earth does he think he is?" The question was not addressed to Cézanne in particular, but to the human species at large. Who did they all think they were? "It's like Arnold Bennett in the Dolomites," I said, suddenly remembering a scene happily immortalized in a snapshot of A.B. some 4 or 5 years before his death, toddling along a wintry road at Cortina d'Ampezzo. Around him lay the virgin snow. In the background was a more than gothic aspiration of red crags. And there was dear, kind, unhappy A.B., consciously overacting the role of his favorite character in fiction, himself the card in person. There he went, toddling slowly in the bright alpine sunshine, his thumbs in the armholes of a yellow waistcoat, which bulged a little lower down, with the graceful curve of a Regency bow window at Brighton. His head thrown back as though to aim some stammered utterance, howitzer-like, at the blue dome of heaven. What he actually said I have forgotten, but what his whole manner, air, and posture fairly shouted was, "I'm as good as those damned mountains." And in some ways, of course, he was infinitely better, but not, as he knew very well, in the way his favorite character in fiction liked to imagine. Successfully, whatever that may mean, or unsuccessfully, we all overact the part of our favorite character in fiction. and the fact, the almost infinitely unlikely fact, of actually being Cézanne makes no difference. For the consummate painter, with his little pipeline to mind at large, bypassing the brain valve and ego filter, was also, and just as genuinely, this whiskered goblin with the unfriendly eye. For relief, I turned back to the folds in my trousers. "This is how one ought to see," I repeated yet again. And I might have added, "These are the sort of things one ought to look at. Things without pretensions, satisfied to be merely themselves, sufficient in their suchness, not acting a part, not trying insanely to go it alone, in isolation from the Dharma body, in Luciferian defiance of the grace of God. The nearest approach to this," I said, "would be a Vermeer." "Yes, a Vermeer. For that mysterious artist was trebly gifted. With the vision that perceives the Dharma body as the hedge at the bottom of the garden, with the talent to render as much of that vision as the limitations of human capacity permit, and with the prudence to confine himself in his paintings to the more manageable aspects of reality. For though Vermeer represented human beings, he was always a painter of still life. Cézanne, who told his female sitters to do their best to look like apples, tried to paint portraits in the same spirit. But his Pippin-like women are more nearly related to Plato's ideas than to the Dharma body in the hedge. They are eternity and infinity, seen not in sand or flower, but in the abstractions of some very superior brand of geometry. Vermeer never asked his girls to look like apples. On the contrary, he insisted on their being girls to the very limit, but always with the proviso that they refrain from behaving girlishly. They might sit or quietly stand, but never giggle, never display self-consciousness, never say their prayers or pine for absent sweethearts, never gossip, never gaze enviously at other women's babies, never flirt, never love or hate or work. In the act of doing any of these things, they would doubtless become more intensely themselves, but would cease for that very reason to manifest their divine, essential not-self. In Blake's phrase, the doors of Vermeer's perception were only partially cleansed. A single panel had become almost perfectly transparent. The rest of the door was still muddy. The essential not-self could be perceived very clearly in things and in living creatures on the hither side of good and evil. In human beings it was visible only when they were in repose, their minds untroubled, their bodies motionless. In these circumstances, Vermeer could see suchness in all its heavenly beauty, could see and in some small measure render it in a subtle and sumptuous still life. Vermeer is undoubtedly the greatest painter of human still lives. But there have been others, for example, Vermeer's French contemporaries, the Le Nain brothers. They set out, I suppose, to be genre painters, but what they actually produced was a series of human still lives, in which their cleansed perception of the infinite significance of all things is rendered not as with Vermeer by subtle enrichment of color and texture, but by a heightened clarity, an obsessive distinctness of form within an austere, almost monochromatic tonality. In our own day, we have had Vuillard, the painter at his best of unforgettably splendid pictures of the Dharma body manifested in a bourgeois bedroom, of the absolute blazing away in the midst of some stockbroker's family in a suburban garden taking tea. Ce qui fait que l'ancien bandagiste renie le comptoir dont le faste allait chez les passants, c'est son jardin d'Auteuil, où, veufs de tout enceint, les zinnias ont l'air d'être en tôle vernie. For Laurent Taillade, the spectacle was merely obscene. But if the retired rubber goods merchant had sat still enough, Vuillard would have seen in him only the Dharma body, would have painted in the zinnias the goldfish pool, the villa's Moorish tower and Chinese lanterns, a corner of Eden before the fall. But meanwhile my question remained unanswered. How was this cleansed perception to be reconciled with a proper concern with human relations, with the necessary chores and duties, to say nothing of charity and practical compassion? The age-old debate between the actives and the contemplatives was being renewed, so far as I was concerned, with an unprecedented poignancy. For until this morning I had known contemplation only in its humbler, its more ordinary forms, as discursive thinking, as a rapt absorption in poetry or painting or music, as a patient waiting upon those inspirations without which even the prosiest writer cannot hope to accomplish anything, as occasional glimpses in nature of Wordsworth's something far more deeply interfused, as systematic silence leading sometimes to hints of an obscure knowledge. But now I knew contemplation at its height. At its height, but not yet in its fullness. For in its fullness the way of Mary includes the way of Martha, and raises it, so to speak, to its own higher power. Mescaline opens up the way of Mary, but shuts the door on that of Martha. It gives access to contemplation, but to a contemplation that is incompatible with action, and even with the will to action, the very thought of action. In the intervals between his revelations, the mescaline taker is apt to feel that though in one way everything is supremely as it should be, in another there is something wrong. His problem is essentially the same as that which confronts the quietist, the arhat, and on another level the landscape painter and the painter of human still lives. Mescaline can never solve that problem. It can only pose it apocalyptically for those to whom it had never before presented itself. The full and final solution can be found only by those who are prepared to implement the right kind of Weltanschauung by means of the right kind of behavior and the right kind of constant and unstrained alertness. Over against the quietist stands the active contemplative, the saint, the man who, in Eckhart's phrase, is ready to come down from the seventh heaven in order to bring a cup of water to his sick brother. Over against the arhat, retreating from appearances into an entirely transcendental nirvana, stands the bodhisattva, for whom suchness and the world of contingencies are one, and for whose boundless compassion every one of those contingencies is an occasion not only for transfiguring insight, but also for the most practical charity. And in the universe of art, over against Vermeer and the other painters of human still lives, over against the masters of Chinese and Japanese landscape painting, over against Constable and Turner, against Sisley and Seurat and Cézanne, stands the all-inclusive art of Rembrandt. These are enormous names, inaccessible eminences. for myself on this memorable May morning, I could only be grateful for an experience which had shown me, more clearly than I had ever seen it before, the true nature of the challenge and the completely liberating response. Let me add, before we leave this subject, that there is no form of contemplation, even the most quietistic, which is without its ethical values. Half at least of all morality is negative, and consists in keeping out of mischief. The Lord's Prayer is less than 50 words long, and 6 of those words are devoted to asking God not to lead us into temptation. The one-sided contemplative leaves undone many things that he ought to do, but to make up for it, he refrains from doing a host of things he ought not to do. The sum of evil, Pascal remarked, would be much diminished if men could only learn to sit quietly in their rooms. The contemplative, whose perception has been cleansed, does not have to stay in his room. He can go about his business, so completely satisfied to see and be a part of the divine order of things, that he will never even be tempted to indulge in what Traherne called the dirty devices of the world. When we feel ourselves to be sole heirs of the universe, when the sea flows in our veins and the stars are our jewels, when all things are perceived as infinite and holy, what motive can we have for covetousness or self-assertion, for the pursuit of power or the drearier forms of pleasure? Contemplatives are not likely to become gamblers or procurers or drunkards. They do not, as a rule, preach intolerance or make war, do not find it necessary to rob, swindle, or grind the faces of the poor. And to these enormous negative virtues, we may add another, which, though hard to define, is both positive and important. The Arhat and the Quietist may not practice contemplation in its fullness, but if they practice it at all, they may bring back enlightening reports of another, a transcendent country of the mind. And if they practice it in the height, they will become conduits through which some beneficent influence can flow out of that other country into a world of darkened selves, chronically dying for lack of it.